Well, it is a delight to have in studio Logan Gates. And Logan is, I could get to the short strokes. You're an itinerant speaker with Rabbi Zechariah Ministries. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Based in Toronto.
And how long have you been involved with RZIM?
I've been involved with the ministry for about 4 years. When I went to seminary in the UK, I was involved in their training program. It's called the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. I spent 2 years there, and then I moved here 2015.
It takes a special kind of person, such as yourself, to be involved in the art, if you will, of apologetics. Define for me and our listeners exactly what apologetics is.
Yeah, apologetics, it doesn't mean to go around apologizing to people. It's actually a word that comes from the Bible. It's a word, apologia, which in the Greek means a reasoned defense. And so traditionally, apologetics has taken its cue from the Bible. Peter talks about how every Christian should be prepared to make a defense, to make an apologia for the reason for the hope that they have. And so in that sense, Christian apologetics is making a defense, a reasoned defense of the Christian faith to show that it has those two elements. It speaks to reason, and of course it speaks to hope as well.
Can faith and reason live in the same house?
I think so. I think that often we put up a false dichotomy, the sense in which we have to choose between faith and reason, whereas I sense from the very earliest days of the Christian faith, it was a religion that wasn't a blind faith. It wasn't one asking you to believe things for which there was no evidence. Instead, I think it was a faith that said, there are things that have really happened surrounding this person of Jesus, that the things that he did, the things he said about himself, and ultimately centering on this claim of the resurrection. And if those things happened, well, then that has implications, implications that I think bring us to the question of faith, which is more than just reason. Mm. But as C.S. Lewis talked about, faith is holding on to what your reason arrives at, following the evidence where it leads. But I would say the Christian faith makes the case that the evidence leads to the person of Jesus, who calls us to follow him. So I think that's the relationship I see between those two things, faith and reason.
We were discussing earlier, and I brought up something that I've been wrestling with, that faith is the substance of things not seen, the evidence of things hoped for. Or is it the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for? But nonetheless, wouldn't that not necessarily preclude, let's say, the various treatises of faith coming from evidence that demands a verdict? In other words, if faith has arrived because the evidence is overwhelming, then the evidence, though, is something that is more caught than taught. It's more God-defined and the irresistible, let's say, the irresistible grace of the gospel. Isn't that some kind of a conflict, or am I getting wrapped up in something that really I shouldn't be?
Well, I think that those two things can exist together. I would say that anyone who's been a Christian will know that often you might believe that the Christian faith is true. You might believe that God loves you because you see that through what he's done for you, sending his son to die on the cross. But it might not always feel that way. And I think in that sense, what faith is in that moment, when you feel far from God and yet you've seen what he's done for you on your behalf and you've placed your trust in him and committed your life to him, what faith is in that case is holding on to something in which you cannot see, in a sense in which, you know, the sun is shining today, I can know that by seeing it, but faith doesn't operate that way. But I don't think that's to say it's not based on reason. I might know that God loves me. Love is demonstrated in action. I see the ultimate action of God's love as the cross. I know that in my mind. But I think what makes faith faith in that sense is now holding on to what my mind is telling me. And that's hard, because it's not always something as immediate and in front of me as I want to see. So in that sense, I think all through the early Christian faith, when you see Paul going to the synagogues and reasoning with people, he's using his reason. He's making a defense. And yet, I think what he's calling people to is to step out into the relationship with God that you can have, which is a step of faith, but it's faith that's based on things that you can know.
Do you think, unfortunately, we don't have the faith of children, yet that is the faith that saves? We tend to overthink everything. Everything is a matter of, well, the great antinomy, man's free will, God's sovereignty. You know, it seems to be a faith of contradictions, a faith of ironies.
Yes. Again, I think often what we do is we see throughout the Bible those two elements. We see, in one sense, God's absolute sovereignty. This is a God who chooses a people, Israel, who Jesus says, you know, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. This is a God who is very active in the work of salvation. And I think to the extent that for the Christian, looking back on your life and seeing the journey maybe that God has brought you on to come and know him, you see that it is something that God has done himself. And yet, I think the other strand we find in Scripture is, you know, think about the whole Old Testament. A large part of that has, you know, it's a prophetic call for Israel to turn from their ways and to turn back to God. A lot of it is commandments. God is saying, this is how I'm calling you to live. And I think that part of the Old Testament presumes a kind of real deliberate action that we can take on our part. And in that sense, I think what we have here is not necessarily a contradiction, God's sovereignty, human responsibility. I think that the way those two fit together, I'm not quite sure. But I think in strict terms, a contradiction is something like it's A or and not A. It can't be this and then exactly the opposite at the same time. You can't have that. That would be a contradiction. But to have A and B, two things that are different, and I might not understand how they fit together, I would say that's not quite a contradiction. Both things are there. God is actively drawing people to him, and yet I think there is a sense in which the Bible ends with an invitation for us to respond to this message that's been portrayed.
Israel is sort of an object lesson, isn't it, in the life of a believer. It's a matter of blessings and curses. And God said, if you do this, I will do that. But if you do that, and no doubt there were times probably that Israel, perhaps like us, saying, choose someone else. You know, we're the chosen people. Would you find somebody else? Because in many cases, it would seem they were more disobedient than obedient. They keep forgetting, don't they? As we keep forgetting.
Absolutely, yes. And I think, you know, we often, maybe as Christians, we set aside the Old Testament as, well, that was for that time, and now we focus on the new. But I think we really see that the two are very, very closely linked. All throughout the Old Testament, we have these promises, or covenants, as they're sometimes called. And one of those covenants was with Moses, and that covenant was two ways. You know, God said, you are going to be my people, and I'm going to show myself to the world through you. But that means you have a part in this as well, that I'm calling you to live for me. And we see that, you know, Israel fell far short of that, as we do today. But I think what's powerful when it comes to the person of Jesus and how that fits in with the Old Testament is it puts us looking back at Moses, but also at the covenant, the promise God made to Abraham. And that promise was one that was unilateral. That was God saying, I'm going to make you a nation, and I'm going to bless the whole world through you. And that's, I think, when we see the person of Jesus, we find here is the person who fulfilled all of those laws that we could not. And because he did that, God now looking at us when we've come to relationship with him through repentance and faith, now all of a sudden we see what that promise to Abraham meant long ago, that actually the world is blessed through the people of Israel that's brought about this, you know, this descendant of David, descendant of Abraham and Moses, Jesus. We can place our trust in him and have that perfect righteousness that Jesus had applied to us. That's available to all. And that's how I see the whole story continuing throughout the old and the new.
Yeah, that anticipated the Gentiles, I believe, for the first time, that basically all the nations shall be blessed through you. And that was for the chosen people. That was a revelation. I wonder how they would get down on something like that, how they interpreted that. Does that mean, did they say that the world was eventually going to be all Jewish? They certainly didn't anticipate that the choice of God would be among the Gentiles, too.
That's certainly true, and I think that it's one of the reasons why Jesus got in hot water. A lot of people didn't like the sort of things he was saying about what it means to be a true son of Abraham. That's not something that comes through a physical descendant. Physical descendants, it doesn't come through necessarily even going through the right ceremonies. You know, we might see that now today as going to church. Actually, Jesus comes in with this provocative claim, and he talks about people in the Old Testament who were included into God's family who actually weren't Israelites. People like Rahab, the prostitute, or the leper, the one leper who was, you know, who was not Naaman, the Syrian, not an Israelite. And I think what that's showing us is Jesus is saying the people who are pleasing to God are those not necessarily from a certain cultural background, or those even who participate in religious ceremony. I think Jesus cares about his church, and so that's right. why going to church matters. But I think what the heart of that is, Jesus is saying, I care about the person who, you know, humbly comes before me, who has committed themselves to me, and who trusts in their approval in God's eyes, not through the things that they've done, but for what God has done for them. And that's that element you were talking about of salvation being something God does, and that's where the emphasis is.
As you go through the day and you don't wear any kind of uniform or indication that you are a believer, a very much a thinking believer, one who wants to share faith but also wrestle with the doubts many in society have, many even in the church have, what is the most common presentation or question you get on a, let's say, on a day-to-day basis, whether you're flying somewhere or sitting in a in a train station where you just sort of get talking with somebody, and then you it's not that you're coy about it, but you say, I work with a ministry. What's the first thing, the most common response you get to that revelation that you're preaching Christ?
Well, I think it often is along the lines of, oh, I see that you're a religious person.
Yeah.
And often, sometimes that will be followed up with something very honest along the lines of, you know, I wish that I could believe, you know. And I had a professor in seminary who used to say, you know, often when people use that kind of language talking about, you know, how I'd love to have faith, what they're really saying, you know, if we really think of someone who's not a Christian, someone maybe who doesn't believe in God, when they think about a Christian who, you know, let's say, prays to this person who doesn't actually exist, you know, we have a word for that in our society. We call it insanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so when I know, as some of my friends say that sort of thing to me, that what they're really saying is, you know, Logan, I'm so glad that you're a Christian. In other words, I'm so glad that, you know, you're insane.
Mm-hmm.
And I can really see the way you find meaning and purpose in your insanity. I'd love to believe. In fact, I'm so wanting those things perhaps in my own life that I'm willing to be insane, but I'm a rational person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite that willing to step out into insanity to believe those things. And I think this is where I'm really happy to step in and say, you know, well, what makes you think that? What makes you think that you couldn't believe? What makes you think that the Christian faith is just insanity? And that's when often they ask me, well, why do you think it's true? And it gives me the chance to talk about why I am a Christian, why I think the Christian faith really has more answers than any other worldview on market, more than atheism, more than any other religion, more than agnosticism. Mm-hmm. I think the Christian faith really makes sense of the life that we live, the world that we experience, and I do think there's evidence for it.
When you're debating and a room full, let's say at a university, and you get a room full of people that are there, what are they there for, do you think, off the top, to find out, to why maybe want to see you ground into the dust over your beliefs or the lack of reason, that type of thing? And after that, the number two question is, what is it that usually turns them? Is there a pivotal point, and you can almost see it, where you said something or presented something that to them was a surprise?
Yes, that's a great question. I think that often, you know, as humans, we all have mixed motives. Mm. You know, I think the people, even I'd say, who you go to church one Sunday, you know, you imagine there's some people there who maybe are committed Christians. They really believe this is true. There are probably others maybe who've been invited along by a friend, still sort of thinking things through. Probably others who not quite sure why they're there. They've just sort of stopped in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that often, for me personally, I want to speak to the person who maybe is still thinking things through or not really sure what they're there for. I think often the first thing I try to do is just to get a sense of where people are at. You know, what do you make of God? You know, has there ever been anything or an experience or anything that you've maybe thought about that's made you think there might be a God? And I think from there I'm often seeing the turning point for people being, I think, seeing that faith could be something that actually could make a difference in their life.
Mm.
I think there are many people in Canada today who would say, you know, religion, it's sort of like any other hobby, ice hockey, curling. You know, I have plenty of hobbies. I'm sort of a busy person already. Why do I need this extra thing in my life? But I think this is where suddenly when people begin to see the Christian faith, one, that it makes claims, you know, not just to be something that's a hobby or something you participate in on a Sunday, but something that's really true. But then also once they see that the Christian faith is something that's really beautiful, I think it's when it's those two things come together, when you see that actually here's something that I would want to be true. Almost that it would be too good to be true. You know, here you have the maker of the universe who knows you inside and out and has, you know, not just told you about his love in words, I love you, I love you. A lot of people can say, I love you, but how can you know that love's really there? You know, one pastor likes to put it, you know, the Christian faith, instead of giving you words about love, gives you a story. And at the heart of that story is a cross. Mm. And this is a God who's not just an idea or a doctrine, but a person who you can know. He can step into your life and step into your pain and brokenness and your past and your hopes and your dreams in a way that's unlike anything else. I wanted to speak to someone and say, wouldn't you want that to be true? Mm. You know, you might say it's just pie in the sky, but you know, C.S. Lewis used to say, well, that still leaves the question of whether that there is pie in the sky or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's often what gets people looking at the evidence for the resurrection. Is there any evidence for that? Evidence for, is the Bible reliable? Evidence, I think, that comes from philosophy, from science, from the way the Christian faith makes sense of the world, makes sense of our hurts, makes sense of our longings and desires. And I think that that's when suddenly, once they see it's something beautiful, that many people, I think, go to move on to find that it's true and find, perhaps even more importantly, that it's real. That this is something you can actually, this is a person you can know and have a friendship, a relationship with, and it's intimate, and it can be the central part of your life and can give you a hope that you never had before. And I think that's often what happens to people, is all those pieces come together.
Isn't there a great danger that we as Christians, when we're witnessing to somebody else, we want to, even as a church or a corporate body, want to massage people into the kingdom, that this is pretty easy stuff. As opposed to, remember, Jesus said, go sell all you have, then come follow me, or count the cost of discipleship. In other words, there has to be that demarcation between what you are and what you're willing to leave behind, and commitment to Christ, knowing that he'll take care of all of that after that. But you have to make a commitment based on you are leaving things behind. You know, you have to make that. So how do we, from not let's say, soft-selling our faith, but also it's hard. Be prepared. Otherwise, they're like the parable of the soils. The seeds are barely in the ground, and all of a sudden something comes along, and, well, lo and behold, they're gone because that was not planted deep enough, and that's what the commitment takes to, override that initial reluctance to be uncomfortable.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that often the Christian message just gets shortened to, you know, God has sent his son to die for all of humanity. And I think that in a way that can become for us, if that's just, you know, a random person 2,000 years ago dying for the whole of the human race, it can just be a bit like maybe the Santa Claus love. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's nice that Santa Claus loves me, but it makes no real difference in my life.
Right.
But I think, you know, here's an interesting illustration I heard the other day about, you know, imagine, let's say we're near the lake here, Lake Ontario, and, you know, let's say after this interview we go down with a few friends, we're all walking beside the shore of the lake, and I'd begin to feel, you know, just very grateful for these new friendships I've made here, and I decide to just jump into the water and show you how much I love you. What do? I swim out as far as I can and I drown. You know, are you all going to look at each other and say, oh man, he loved us so much? No, of course not. You're going to say, who is this crazy guy we brought in here? But, you know, let's say we change the story. Let's say that instead of me just jumping in and drowning, one of you fell in. Maybe a current took you out, and I jumped in and rescued you. I drowned in the process. You know, would that be love? And I think, of course, that changes the story. And I think in the same way, when you see that this person of Jesus isn't just some random person dying on the cross for all of humanity, but that here's someone, the Son of God, laying down his life for you, that, you know, there's a drop of blood with your name on it. And when that sort of thing touches your heart, it will change you. And maybe the best language to speak about that kind of change is the language of following. That's what Jesus did. What it means to be a Christian is to follow Jesus.
Christ followers.
Yes, yeah. And you've pointed out that, you know, following, if you follow someone, one, that means you leave something behind. The powerful thing about following is it's something that can begin wherever you are. You can be 10,000 miles away from God, and following is something you can start right now. It involves a reorientation of the self towards God. It's something you can start if you're 10 feet away from God. But the other thing that's involved in following is that it's holistic. It involves, you know, you turn your head, your eyes, your whole self is now committed to following someone. But the central thing is, you know, the Christian faith is not a bunch of rules. Just in itself, what it is, it's seeing that Jesus on the cross is God giving you everything. And when that touches your heart, it can't help but make you respond and give you everything in return. And that's, I think, the cost that you're talking about. I still think it's a beautiful cost to think about, because at the heart of the Christian faith, we see this is worth it. It's a cost. It's costly to be a Christian. It's costly to follow Christ, but it's something that's worth it. You know, like that parable you mentioned of the pearl of great price that a merchant finds, that Jesus tells this story. Merchant finds this pearl. He's a vendor of pearls. This one's beyond anything else he's ever seen. He sells all he has and buys it. That's this idea at the heart of the Christian faith. You find something beautiful, and you give everything you have for it, and you receive everything more than you ever had before. It was a transaction that was worth it. The merchant walks away with joy. Mm. It's costly, but it's worth it. That's the Christian message.
Is the church keeping up with presenting to, if you will, a new age of people, a different generation, presenting the gospel as the gospel is rather than the gospel as people would like it to be?
I think that the church notices that here in the West we're moving away from a Christian foundation that was there centuries before. That's really been the soil in which our Western democracy, the values of human dignity, freedom, those have all grown up in Christian soil. I think that there's a sense in which, you know, now that we're moving away from that foundation, that there's fear. What's happening to the West today? And I think in the church that often can be exhibited through a sense in which we need to distort or dumb down the message of the Christian faith to make it more palatable. Mm. And I think what's amazing about this is, you know, when you look at churches that are growing across Canada, it's ones that, you know, aren't actually on the cutting edge necessarily of the best media production and, you know, the hippest youth pastors. Those things can help, but it's actually very traditional Orthodox Christian doctrines that are characterizing these churches that are growing. Mm. A deep belief in the authority of Scripture, the message of the gospel in its full sense of both heaven but also hell, the reality that there is an option put to us, that we can reject God. This is no forcing of the hand. And that's a tough message in Canada today, to think about any kind of judgment. We don't like that at all. But I think that what's drawing people to faith in that sort of historic Orthodox Christianity is it's something that's real. You know, we spoke about Santa Claus. I think there's a kind of love that we could have for the world, and we want to have, you know, we want to all be kind, loving people, and I'm the first one to say we should do that. But I think there's a sense in which we have to appreciate that the world is also a broken place, and the love of Santa Claus is great, but it's not going to patch up the brokenness in my family or the disappointments I've faced in my life. I think that what people are looking for is something real, something that can be known. And I think in this person of Jesus, who himself wept, who himself suffered, who faced evil himself, what we find is a message that takes, you know, as real the evil in the world, the evil inside each of our hearts. Mm. But it's one that overcomes it, one that says, actually, God cares about this evil. He stepped in and done something about it so that we can know him now, and so that one day, you know, all will be made right.
Do you think we betray our doubts as to whether Jesus is enough when he has to be sold rather than be presented?
I think you're right, yes. I think that
we're wrapping up in programs.
It needs to be Jesus and.
Yeah.
Jesus and something
Galatianism,
else.
Exactly. Jesus plus. Jesus, you know. And we'll all of a sudden have churches that are more known for their programs or their music rather than Christ crucified. You know, this is the very core, because we have, I think, the church has entered into an age of great doubt as to whether this is enough to really work. Somewhat shy, somewhat ambivalent about the power of the gospel, that basically we are to proclaim the gospel. God does the rest. God reveals then this irresistible grace that once presented, you say, my, remember Jesus and Peter, and, you know, who do you say I am? Art the Christ, the Son of the living God? And Jesus commanded him, said, this was revealed to you not by flesh and blood, not by programs, not by good neighbors, but my Father who is in heaven. So in other words, there was a God-originated revelation that was God-sustained and God-confirmed. And yet, somehow we in the church today, I've seen many churches, it's just like they don't really believe that. They've got to gussy it up.
I think you're right. I think that is sadly something we're seeing. I think as well that in a sense, the church is right to grapple with how do we get this message across. You know, even when we think about the reason why we translate our Bibles into English, because we believe that actually we want to put this, we believe that this message is translatable, we want to put it into a format in which we can really engage with what it says. And I think in the same way, maybe what the church needs to think about is not a changing of the message, not avoiding something like talking about sin or judgment, but thinking about actually how can we listen to the concerns and even the desires of our culture and then articulate the goodness of the gospel in those terms. Mm-hmm. So take, for instance, this concept of judgment. That's very unpopular today to be judging anyone. But I think at the same time, there is a sense in which, you know, the fact, one, we might say that we have human rights standards in the world today, that that's something we care about and we make judgments on because we believe in the sanctity, the sacredness of human beings, and especially of those most vulnerable, those abused, downtrodden in society. And I think that actually if we were to speak of real love, I think we would need to speak of some concept of real judgment. Imagine a father, maybe, who has a young daughter who comes home and says she's been bullied at school. And let's say the father just says, you know, well, that's just how it is sometimes, and takes no care for what this child is suffering. We would say, is there real love there? Mm-hmm. If the father really loves that child, he's gonna have a sense of judgment about the injustice that this child is facing. And I think in the same way, that what we see in the Christian understanding is that true love, when we speak about a God who loves, if he really loves us as his children, surely he will care about the ways that we hurt one another. And we all do this. Mm-hmm. You know, an interesting theologian from Yale University, Miroslav Volf, comes from the Balkans originally, and he speaks about how, you know, in the West, often we've been conflict-free, wonderfully. We're so thankful for that. But maybe he wonders we've lost sight of how in much of the world retribution and vengeance is something that very much characterizes the way the world works. He says that was the case in the Balkans. That is the case today. And he says, the question then is, what will keep you from picking up arms to beat back the person who's abused you before? And I think he says, this is where actually this concept of a God who will judge. He says, as growing up in this war-torn part of the world, I can say my family's been wronged, my nation's been wronged, but I don't need to stand up and exert vengeance now on their part. Why? Because I believe there is a God who is just and fair. And because of that confidence in the justice of God, I can move forward and forgive and have grace. I think that message, when we articulate it in those terms, we see that actually you cannot have love without some degree of judgment. And when we think about the love of God is something that actually allows us to love one another, the justice of God that allows us to love one another, it's powerful.
And he has eternity to effect justice. We think we've got to wrap it up in our lifetime, don't we?
That's it, yes.
Logan Gates, we could go on probably endlessly. Thank you so much with RZIM, who's impacted so many lives for so many years, and we just consider it a real privilege to have you and be able to articulate some of your thinking, some of your deep thinking. We appreciate that, dropping by our studio.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Radio, we're the original social media, but you can still find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and more. Look us up at MyJoy Radio. See you there.